welcome to 2 and 2 Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Livonier, and coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, episodes of Our Freedom's Blessings and Adventures in Research. But right now, from the National Association of Manufacturers and hosted by radio legend, even at that time, Graham McNamee, it's Defense for America. This episode focuses on military manufacturing and was heard on NBC on March 15, 1941.
Defense for America. Each week at the same time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the National Association of Manufacturers, has brought you this authentic series of on-the-spot reports from the great industries engaged in supplying Defense for America. That great industrial giant of defense production, which we have seen in action during the past year, is almost entirely dependent on petroleum and its products. Oil, the lifeblood of defense. The black gold that keeps the wheels rolling, that greases the gears and runs the motors that turn out arms for America. During the past few months, there has been an effort to restrict gasoline consumption on the Atlantic seaboard, to relieve the increased pressure on our transportation system brought about by the national defense. Some of our listeners have already been affected by that restriction. Others have merely read of it. Everyone wants to know what is being done about it. Today, Defense for America will tell you what's being done about it. We'll take you where things are being done and talk with the men who are doing them. So join us, you women who have sewing machines, you men who drive cars, you people who burn oil for heat. Join us and hear another thrilling chapter in Defense for America. The story of oil begins with great beasts rising from primordial ooze and goes through the lush tropical age of the newly spawned earth. As the crust cooled, it ground and pressed itself into the fantastic shapes we call mountain ranges, divided itself into land and sea, and through the heat and pressure squeezed its covering of vegetation into coal and great shining underground pools of precious oil. But bountiful as nature was, she paid but little attention to the convenience of those who would one day use her products. For although oil is found in vast quantities in 23 states and used throughout the country, most of it is found in the great Southwest, while most of it is used on the Atlantic seaboard. And so today, the story of oil is largely the story of its transportation. The story of the Atlantic shortage is a story of a temporary lack of transportation, a situation that is being corrected as rapidly as possible. How? Let's find out. Let's go to a dock at the end of Portland Street in South Portland, Maine, and hear what's being done.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Graham McNamee speaking. I'm standing at the first stop on the now famous shortcut to Montreal, the Portland Pipeline, which is rapidly nearing completion. Not far out from shore, and you can probably hear their signals, a group of four great dredges are making life miserable for the fish and lobsters of Upper Casco Bay as they tear out great chunks of sea bottom to make room for the seagoing oil tankers that will discharge their cargoes here. All around me is that well-known scene of activity. Things are being done here, and in a big way, believe me. Tractors to the left of me, tractors to the right of me, and dredges out in front of me. I'm surrounded by what amounts to a paradise for an old 6th Avenue excavation watcher like myself. For here, where I stand now, is the beginning of the great pipeline that will carry oil to Montreal, Canada, saving the hard-pressed oil tankers a 10 or 12-day voyage and releasing them for the mighty important job of keeping America's Atlantic coast supplied with vital fuel oil. Most American motorists get an average of, somewhere near 16 miles per gallon of gasoline, as I used to call it occasionally. In my car, I just get about 8 miles per gallon, and I'm not fooling. Anyhow, you can see that I'm really three times as interested in the so-called gasoline shortage as you are. What's a shortage for you is mighty like a desert for me. So I'm very happy to be able to talk the situation over with Captain Wallace R. Finney, president of the Portland Pipeline Company and technical advisor on the new $75 million Texas to New York pipeline. Say, Mr. Finney, I might add, is known to oil men all over the world as Captain. Isn't that right, sir?
Yes, Mr. McNamee. And while we're on the subject of titles, I'd like to clear up one point. A great many people have the idea that I'm a sea captain or an army officer, when actually I'm nothing but a California captain. That means I received the nickname in school as a high jumper on the track team.
All right, sir. Thanks for the explanation. But you know a lot of other captains are in the same boat. Well, I'll smile when I call you captain. But what about this so-called shortage of gasoline? Uh-oh, there, I said it.
Actually, Graham, there's no shortage of gasoline or crude oil in this country. No nation in the world can match our supply of fuel oil, either in quality or quantity. Just to give you an idea of what I mean, we produce 67% of the world's entire supply of gasoline.
Well, that sounds like enough gas even for my car.
Well, your car must be a Lula, Graham, but we can turn out enough gas to keep it running all right. The problem is getting it to you.
Well, of course, that means transportation, by rail, tanker, or pipeline.
Right, and that's why the petroleum industry is constructing thousands of miles of pipeline this year and contracting for the launching of 145 new oil tankers.
A little later on this program, we're going down to the Sun Shipyards at Chester, Pennsylvania, Mr. Finney, and learn some more about the new tankers. I think we'd better talk about dredging. That's something I know about. And besides, we have Don Cordray out there in the middle of the bay with a short wave set, and he's probably getting lonesome. How about it, Don?
Lonesome, did you say, Graham? There's too much going on out here to get lonesome. For example, I'm standing alongside of Captain Thompson. Now, here's really a busy man, giving hand signals, whistle signals, and pretty nearly every other kind of signal possible. These dredges out here are really pulling up the bottom. Now tell me, Captain Tom, how much does that big bucket hold?
About 6 cubic yards.
Say, that's enough to load about 3 good-sized trucks, isn't it?
Yes, but we put them out into a scow.
That's right, and each dredge empties its own individual scow alongside, and they're pretty big ones, too, that's sure. Now, tell me this. What do they do with the scow when it's loaded, Captain?
Take it out to sea and dump it.
Now, there's the boom swinging in on that dredge across the way, Captain. And I notice the bucket brings up water and all. By the way, did they ever catch any fish in those things?
Sure, sometimes lobster, too. Another dredge caught an 8-pound lobster in Boston Harbor one time.
By the way, what are they doing right now?
They are putting down the spud.
That's no potato, by the way. Each dredge has 4 spuds. They're square beams that run up and down at each corner of the dredge, sort of like stilts. Evidently, they're stuck into the mud bottom to hold the boat against the current. Am I right about that, Captain?
Sure. Also, they hold the dredge against the pull of the bucket.
You know, I'd like to try dredging just once, if it's all right with you. Do you
sure.
mind if I try?
Go ahead.
All right,
put
now.
Put your left hand on this lever.
Put my left hand on this lever here.
And your left foot on that pedal there.
On this pedal. What kind of a car am I driving?
A mud digger.
Oh, a mud digger.
Yes.
It's a new kind of a car. I never heard of that.
Yes.
Now, am I doing all right here?
Yeah, doing fine.
Now, what am I? How deep am I supposed to go down?
About 18 feet.
About 18 feet. Now, yeah. Which lever? Is this the right lever here?
That's the right lever there, yeah.
That's the one in my left hand. Now, the one in my right hand. What do I do with that?
You pull that now.
Pull that now.
Yeah, and once the bucket gets up.
Well, am I pulling it up too fast?
No, it was right.
All right, swell. Oh, what am I going to get, though? That's what I'm wondering.
You'll get gray clay.
Gray clay?
Yes.
That looks like Graham McNamee to me. Well, thank you very, very kindly, Captain. And I do want to thank you for your instructions and for being with us. And by the way, how am I doing from where you are, Graham?
It didn't look so good to me, Don. Now you just dig that mud out of your eyes and ears and throat, and we'll just run along and get ahead now. I think you need a little practice before you make a real good dredger. And while you're practicing, we're going to visit the Sun Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company at Chester, Pennsylvania.
This is George Hicks speaking to you from the great sprawling web of girders and ways that is the Sun Shipyard. Towering above and around me on every side are ships in every possible stage of construction. Just a few hours ago, a new freighter was launched here. Just a few days from now, a new freighter will be started where the old one was built. This is a fantastic place with an endless variety of sights and sounds. And there's something unreal about it, too, for everything is on such a gigantic scale here that it dwarfs the men whose handiwork it is. Not far from where I stand is a great tangled mass of ship's anchors, each the size of an automobile. Beyond the anchors lies coil after coil of heavy chain, and rearing sharply against the sky stand the high prows of ships, one beyond the other, into the distance. Altogether, it's a thrilling scene. The scaffolding, the girders, the great traveling cranes like monsters gliding on their 4 stilt-like legs and swinging huge bulkheads and plate with all the ease of a giant playing with a toy. And against this immense backdrop, men are constantly moving to and fro. Men with weird masks like those of old-time English knights, the welders, men guiding the monster cranes that so efficiently and humbly do their will. Men forging red-hot steel into propeller shafts. Men building the tankers and freighters that guarantee defense for America at sea. For this is the Sun Shipyard, whose men are building 87 tankers for the United States Maritime Commission and 31 for private companies. 118 out of the total 145 ships to be built. Here beside me is Mr. John Pugh, Jr., whose father and boss, as president of the Sun Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company, is largely responsible for the tremendous scene of activity I see all around me here. Mr. Pugh, it seems to me that a lot of the construction here is new. Is that right?
Yes, last year we had 8 shipways. During March of this year, we began construction on 12 additional ways. They'll be completed by the end of this year, and the first tanker will be launched a short time later.
From 8 to 20. In other words, you'll have more than doubled your facilities by the end of the year.
That's right, just as we've already doubled our working force, and expect to double it again.
How many men have you now, Mr. Pugh?
We did have a little over 4,000. We now have 10,000, and expect to have 20,000 next year.
Well, where will you get them?
We're training new men right along, Mr. Hicks. As fast as they're ready, we put them to work.
Well, how many tankers do you expect to be launching when everything's underway?
Approximately 20 tankers every 4 months.
20? Boy, that is production.
Yes, and the majority are pretty big craft, 521 feet in length.
How can you turn them out so fast?
We've eliminated riveting as much as possible, using our electric welding process.
Yeah?
I think the easiest way to describe our operation is to say that we put 2 huge sheets of steel on a table and draw them together, end to end.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're being held in place, we seal them with an electric torch. This operation is just like a seamstress who sews 2 pieces of cloth together, excepting that the 2 plates after welding actually become 1 solid plate.
I see.
Then, too, we have perfected a large-scale mass production system of assembly, whereby much of the work is prefabricated in the shop and merely assembled on the ways to make a ship.
Well, but even so, only 4 months to build 20 ships of this size seems to me to be something pretty terrific.
I suppose it is, but we've done it before, so we know we can do it again. During the past 25 years, including all the ships you see under construction, we have launched and will launch tankers with a total capacity of 504 million gallons. The 87 tankers we are to build in the next 3 years for the Maritime Commission alone total 513 million gallons capacity.
In other words, Mr. Pugh, during the next 3 years, this one shipyard will surpass its own production for the entire past 25 years.
That's it, in tanker construction.
And that's an impressive indication of how great the American industrial capacity really is. I know, Mr. Pugh, that you men building tankers are getting 100% cooperation from all the oil companies using ships to transport oil or gasoline. As a matter of fact, before I left New York, I visited with Mr. Paul H. Harwood, who was called out of retirement 2 years ago to be chairman of the tanker committee that is made up of all the companies using tankers for shipment of oil. This committee has taken the best ideas on tanker operations and made them universal for all tankers flying the American flag and for many carrying oil for Great Britain. Mr. Harwood told me that ships are being run at top speeds all the time, and that the time a tanker was tied up alongside a terminal, unloading or loading, was cut to a minimum because terminal facilities had been standardized. I learned that they're even studying ballast so that an empty tanker hurrying to get another cargo can unload in a minimum of time. But I'm getting off the subject of building boats, Mr. Pugh. Will you tell how your production record is possible?
It's made possible by our men, Mr. Hicks. Men like Sam Adams here, our foreman of welders and burners. Come on over, Sam.
I'll be glad to.
I suspect that you're Scottish, Mr. Adams.
I'm from Scotland by way of Indiana.
I want you to know my mother's name was Mackay. What did you do in Indiana, Mr. Adams?
I was a coal miner.
I see. Before that, you were in Scotland?
No, before that, I was a gold miner in Africa.
Well, you've certainly been around, Sam.
I have that, and I've settled down now. I'll have been here 25 years come August. This is my country now, not forgetting Scotland. They're a wonderful race of people.
Indeed.
My children were born here, and this is where I belong now.
How many children do you have, Mr. Adams?
2. A boy and a girl. The boy is studying for the ministry and doing fine. I'm a mighty proud man to be living here in America. I wandered in here 25 years ago without knowing a soul, and I've made out fine ever since. This is true today. If a man wants to work, he can get ahead.
That's a fine spirit, Mr. Adams. You know, there was another Sam Adams once who was one of the first to sign a document that finished with the words, "With a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That was the Declaration of Independence. And there were two Mr. Adams who afterwards became presidents of the United States.
Well, I hear my doubts about ever becoming president, but I'll do my share as good as any man in my small way.
Right you are, Sam Adams. And I think we're all beginning to understand why the Sun shipyards can do such remarkable speeding up of production. Why all of American industry, with the help of men like yourself, can do the job they've set out to do, make America strong. In your case, Sam Adams, and yours, John Pugh, you're building great seagoing oil tankers, which are as necessary to national defense as Army tanks. And I guess if men like you can work night and day to clear up the shipping situation, we motorists can afford to be patient and careful for a few months on gas supply while you're doing it. And as for you, Graham McNamee, and that car of yours, my suggestion is that you put it away in a garage, or better still, a museum. As though saying, I'll let you answer from the corner of Sawyer Street and Maple Avenue in South Portland, Maine.
Mr. Graham McNamee again, ladies and gentlemen. Since speaking to you last, I've traveled a short distance, or quite a distance, away from the waterfront to where a gang of workmen are actually laying down part of the Portland pipeline. That noise you hear in the background is what they call a digger machine. It travels along a pretty fair rate of speed, and behind it is the neatest 4-foot trench you ever saw. 4 feet deep and 2 feet wide, and just as clean as a proverbial whistle. As fast as the digger cuts out the ground, the caps, or tractors, bring up 40-foot lengths of 24-inch pipe, each weighing nearly 4,000 pounds, and start putting it in place to be welded. Altogether, I understand the pipe could be laid at the rate of 500 to 1,000 feet a day. In other words, to bring you this operation at all, we've had to follow along behind this digger, and that's just what we're doing now. Now, here with me is Mr. H.M. Stevenson, chief engineer in charge of construction on the Portland Pipeline. They tell me, Mr. Stevenson, you're unmistakably from Texas, or thereabouts.
That's right, Graham.
What's a Texan doing up here in Maine?
A lot of these Maine folks would like to know that, too. Well, the reason is a simple one. We savvy pipeline construction, whether it's in Texas or Maine or wherever. That's our job, and we do it, wherever it happens to take us, whether it's South America, Africa, or the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Well, I imagine you've worked pretty much all over the world building these pipelines, Mr. Stevenson.
I've been here and there.
You didn't happen to get to Iraq on your travels, did you?
Yes, I did. The Iraq pipeline was one of our jobs.
Was? You mean that tremendous oil line from Iraq to Palestine that the British are defending so vigorously was one of your jobs?
Yep. 1,260 miles of pipe through the desert and volcanic formation. A 14-month job and some job.
That's a job. And how does this job look, sir?
Oh, fine. We haven't run into serious trouble yet. Hit a lot of rock further up the line, but we're getting through. We'll be finished by the second week in October.
Well, now look, Mr. Stevenson, when the pipeline actually goes into operation, what'll happen? We know pretty well what goes on at the tank terminal, but what about the line itself? Do you just pump the oil in and sort of let it take care of itself?
Well, we could do that, but it wouldn't be very efficient. The idea is to keep the oil moving as rapidly as possible. We have 8 what we call booster stations along this particular line.
Uh-huh.
They're pumping stations that keep the oil moving at the rate of 3 miles an hour, for which the line walkers are duly grateful.
Line walkers? What's that?
They walk alongside the pipeline and follow the go-devil.
Oh, now, just a minute. This is too fast. What's a go-devil?
I'd better start at the beginning. You see, Graham, this oil contains a certain percentage of paraffin, some of which coats on the inside of the pipeline. So every so often, we have to run a cleaner through what we call a go-devil. It's a contraption about 3 feet long with rotating knives and scrapers. The pressure of the oil pushes it through the pipe, and just to make sure it doesn't get stuck along the route, a line walker follows it by the sound it makes.
That sure is fascinating.
Oh, it's just routine.
Well, I'd like to hear some more about these just routine things.
There isn't much more to it, Graham. We just put down the pipeline, that's all. Up in the hills, we have to watch out for skunks a good deal.
Uh-oh.
They get in our way once in a while, but we take good care not to get in theirs.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't either. Skunks are pretty curious little devils, aren't they?
They are the cussedest little devils I ever saw. They won't hurry for anybody.
Yes, I know. They're perfectly harmless. Say, tell me, Mr. Stevenson, in connection with the proposed $75 million Texas to New York pipeline, which will be built and used by a number of different oil companies, I was wondering how they'll keep the oil separated.
Why, it keeps itself separated. Take this line, for instance. We'll be shipping all different qualities of oil through, just like trains.
You mean the oil doesn't mix? It goes through the way it's put in?
It does mix a little, but not enough to matter. We even have a dispatcher who's stationed here at this inn. Say, we're going to feed a couple of 100,000 barrels of 30-gravity crude through right on top of some 40-gravity crude. The dispatcher calls up the stations along the route, just like a railroad, tells them what time the new oil should pass their station, how fast it'll be going, and when to expect the end of it. Then they call back and tell whether it's on time or not.
Yeah, and that's just routine, of course.
Better step back just a little, Graham. You're getting close to the hole.
I see they're almost ready to put in another section of pipe. How long do the sections run, Mr. Stevenson?
40 foot in random length, Graham.
Well, 40 feet of pipe is a lot to handle at one time, isn't it, sir?
Sure. This pipe weighs almost 100 pounds per foot.
Golly.
Each length is about 2 tons. But if the pipe companies gave it to us in 40-mile length, we'd make arrangements to use it that way.
I imagine so.
I guess they are about ready. How's it coming, Dub?
Okay, Mr. Stevenson. The cats are bringing it up now.
By the way, I'd like you to meet Graham McNamee. This is J. Dub Arthur, one of our men, Graham.
Are you from Texas, too, J. Dub?
Yes, sir, I sure am.
Well, how do you like it up here in Maine?
I like it fine. So does Ms. Dub.
That's good. Well, tell me, J. Dub, how come the nickname?
I don't know. Just picked it up around the pipeline. In fact, some people think my last name is Dub.
No.
They call my wife Ms. Dub all the time.
All right. I understand a lot of the men came up here in high-heel boots and 10-gallon hats. Is that right?
Yeah, but most of them never saw a horse in their life.
Well, do they sing cowboy songs for the natives?
Some of them do, late Saturday nights, but I never hear any applause.
I see, but you heard the songs. Well, I see they're bringing up 40-foot sections of pipe now, J-Dub. What's that black stuff on the outside?
That's hot dope, Mr. McNamee. E and J enamel. It's for protection against corrosion. This ground around here has a high salt value. Well, and it has to be carefully insulated.
Yeah. Well, the two cats or tractors, one at each end of this long pipe section, have drawn up alongside the waiting ditch left by the digger machine. Now J-Dub is giving his men hand signals. It'll be pretty hard for them to hear over the roar of their powerful machines. The pipe's being lowered slowly. A ton of slick black metal, all ready to be joined to the rest of the 236 miles that goes from here to Montreal, Canada. Now the welding gang has come up, and in hardly any time at all, they'll put a temporary weld on this pipe. And then the whole procedure will just start all over again. The cats are starting back for another section of the pipe. Up ahead, the digger is busily supplying the trench. And down the line away, a group of men are filling in the ditch, which now contains this huge pipe that will soon be carrying oil for Canada, making up for the tankers allotted to Transatlantic Defense Service. I think all of us realize now that the shortage is purely temporary, and that things are being done about it and being done rapidly. Meanwhile, and I speak for myself and my 6-mile-a-gallon jalopy, or maybe 8, a little patience seems indicated, and a willingness to make a small sacrifice for national defense by conserving gasoline as much as possible and by driving reasonably and as little as necessary. And now I'd like to thank all these men who took time out from their vital work to explain the situation and how it's being corrected. Thank you, Mr. Stevenson, for allowing us to follow you around and poke our noses into the workings of the Portland pipeline.
Not at all, Graham. Glad to have you. And by the way, everybody has been making suggestions about that car of yours. I'd like to make a suggestion myself.
Go ahead, Steve.
Why don't you get a horse?
Oh! Good afternoon, all. This is Graham McNamee hastily returning you to New York City.
This is Milo Bolton speaking from New York and bringing to a close this program on the lifeblood of defense, petroleum, and its products. Next week at the same time, Defense for America, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the National Association of Manufacturers, will dramatize the transformation of a great American company from the prosaic business of building railroad cars to a credible arsenal of democracy for Defense for America.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.
Defense for America, on Tuned 2 yesterday, an NBC episode from March 15, 1941. The program sponsored by the National Association of Manufacturers, and during the Second World War, it had created a plant-level employee morale program called Soldiers of Production. And in terms of broadcasting, the NAM would sponsor a program in 1950 called Industry on Parade, which would end up winning a Peabody Award. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now an episode of Our Freedom's Blessings, a syndicated recording from April 19th, 1952, called The Little Black Box.
Bert's a fine old feller, going to be our storyteller. Been around for a century, keeping an eye on you and me.
I'm your storyteller, Uncle York. I've been around a long time. My eyes have seen everything that's ever happened in New York State. I have a story to tell you today, produced and transcribed by the New York State Department of Commerce, and dedicated to the men and women everywhere through whose courage and enterprise we enjoy our freedom's blessings. I bet you never wished you were a fly. Those pesky insects are something most of us don't envy or want to be. But you know, these two-winged critters have got something man was born without. A kind of a sixth sense that keeps them balanced when they're flying. That gives them a sense of their movements in space. Of course, most men never missed having this sixth sense until back in the early 1900s. That was when they began taking off from this solid old planet, Earth, and started trying to defy gravity in flimsy crates called airplanes. It was in the year 1912 when a youngster named Sperry began taking flying lessons at a school in Hammondsport, New York. The school belonged to a fellow named Glenn Curtis, who also had a little plane factory nearby. Well, sir, young Sperry, who everybody called by his nickname, Gyro, took to the air like that fly we were talking about. One summer morning, he came in for a landing, climbed out of the flimsy plane, and walked over to Curtis, who had been watching.
Oh, gosh, Glenn, was I that bad? You don't look very happy.
Gyro, you got to keep the nose down better than that. You were rolling all around. One of these days, you're going to be daydreaming and forget you've got a plane to fly at all.
Yeah, fat chance of forgetting. If you get absent-minded for 1 second and start admiring the scenery, the first thing you know, you're in a stall.
It's tough, Gyro, I know, but you've got to settle down.
But I think some mechanism could make it easier for the pilot.
Now, wait a minute.
You're so busy just trying to keep the nose on the horizon, hold the right wing up, keep the left wing up. Gosh, I don't know.
You're gadget-happy, kid, just because your father's an inventor. You don't think your daddy could adapt his ship's gyro to an airplane, do you?
Glenn, you've been reading my mind.
Well, Gyro, if we add any more weight to the planes we're building now, we'll never get them off the ground.
Oh, it wouldn't have to be so big. You know, Glenn, I'm going to hit my dad with the question. I'll bet he'll come up with an idea.
Maybe so, but it's hard to imagine those little spinning wheels flying a plane better than a pilot.
I think it could, though. Human beings make too many mistakes. What if a gyro could be designed to stabilize a plane so it could measure the angle of the dip of the nose or wing?
Now, why not?
Maybe it could connect with motors that would automatically control the ailerons or elevators, keep them from dipping in the first place.
You make it sound pretty simple, Gyro.
Aw.
Still, if you can get your dad's mind off ships and get him thinking about...
I'm going to write him a letter tonight. Maybe I can put a bug in his ear.
Tell a story of a flying machine, funniest kite you've ever seen.
Gyro Sperry was young Lawrence Sperry, the son of Dr. Elmer Sperry, already world famous as the inventor of the ship's gyro compass, and responsible for patents on hundreds of other successful devices. In Brooklyn, at the small factory where he built ship's gyroscopes, Dr. Sperry responded to his son's letter by setting to work on a gyroscope for an airplane. Meanwhile, back at Hammondsport, Glenn Curtis had big news for Gyro.
Gyro, here's something terrific. How'd you like to win 50,000 francs and a lot of honor? Maybe a medal or two.
Oh, what's up, Glenn?
I just got a notice here from the French War Department. They're sponsoring an international competition for a safe airplane.
Uh-huh.
Purse is 50,000 francs.
Is that so?
Now, have you heard anything from your dad yet on that gyro for a plane?
No, but if I know him, he'll have one for us if he puts his mind to it.
Well, pester him, kid. Find out. If it works, we'll install it in one of my planes, and maybe you'll win that purse.
Look! The American aviator flying toward the judges' stand. They say he has a magic black box in his plane.
Magic? He's a madman. He is standing, too. He has taken his hands off the controls. He is waving his arms about.
The airplane will crash. It has no pilot.
It did not fall on me. It is flying without any pilot.
I told you it was magic.
Yeah, I guess a lot of folks thought it was some kind of magic hanky-panky. But Gyro Sperry was awarded the purse of 50,000 francs because he proved that he had a safe, stabilized airplane thanks to his father's adaptation of the gyroscope. Well, sir, now you'd think an invention like that would be snatched up right away, but something happened right about then. Quick as a summer storm, the First World War blew up, changing a lot of plans. Fighter pilots didn't need stable planes. On the contrary, they wanted them as maneuverable as possible. But young Gyro Sperry didn't lose interest in the possibilities of that little black box. In 1917, he began to work with the Navy on a possible weapon of defense.
Glenn, could you build a plane without any cockpit?
You mean with no place for the pilot?
Yeah. A stabilized plane where you could just set the controls and let her fly a straight course. But she'd have a warhead in the nose.
Are you talking about an aerial torpedo, kid?
Yeah, that's the idea. My father's working with the Navy on it. A plane with no pilot.
Well, I guess we could build one like that, General. Look, tell Dr. Sperry to send me the specifications.
But where the dickens would you test out a torpedo like that?
Oh, on Long Island over the bay. The Navy's interested in the idea, and my father's going to town on it. And I'm just itching to try it out. You see, Commander, the torpedo plane will be catapulted off that track over there.
Yeah.
In some of our tests, she's gone as far as 100 miles. Oh, keep your eye on her. She's due to let go right now.
By George, she takes off just as if she had a pilot. What's her speed?
Oh, about 100. The target is a big sandbar over that way.
What about wind drift? Doesn't that throw her off?
Oh, no, that's all figured into our guidance system. She ought to hit pretty close.
Say, does that flag mark the target?
Yeah, that's it, sir. Hope she hits somewhere near it.
Boy, if we could develop a torpedo like this, we'd knock the heinies right out of their socks.
Well, there she goes, Commander, into a dive. Hit it! Did you see that?
Boy, oh boy!
That was the first guided missile in the history of the world. Sperry's automatic aerial torpedo, guided by the gyro stabilizer. Yeah, Sperry's little automatic pilot was the ancestor of the complicated brain in today's supersonic rockets, experimental drone aircraft, and guided missiles. Developments in aviation began to come thick and fast after World War I. Other Sperry aids to navigation made possible the flights of Amelia Earhart, Doolittle, and many others. Man, thanks to the gyroscopes developed by Sperry, was at last getting his sixth sense. Well, sir, one day in 1933, practically everybody in America was holding their breath. They were waiting for a fellow named Wiley Post to set his plane down at Floyd Bennett Field. He landed safe enough after making the first round-the-world solo flight. The excitement at the airfield was really something, and people all over the country listened to the broadcast.
Congratulations, Mr. Post. I know you must be dying to get some sleep, but everybody wants to know how you kept awake for 7 days.
Well, I could use some sleep right now, but I had a few cat naps. Otherwise, I couldn't have kept going alone. The little black box gets the credit for that.
You mean the automatic pilot, I take it?
Yeah. I'd set the course with the pilot and tie a wrench to my finger, and then I'd doze off for a while. Then when I started to relax, the wrench would slip down and jerk my finger. That would wake me up. I managed to get over 100 catnaps.
Why, that's amazing. How about the weather, Mr. Post?
Well, some of it was pretty bad. I had four times as much bad weather as on the first flight. Boy, without that little box, I never could have made it.
Yeah, Post's little plane, the Winnie Mae, was a real pioneer. Flying alone over oceans and continents on a flyway that's more or less routine today, thanks to the wonderful sixth sense in the little black box. Why, just last year alone, commercial planes took more than 2.5 million passengers across oceans with the help of Sperry navigational equipment.
There were three white gulls a-flying. There were three white gulls a-flying.
Today, 17,000 people work in the Long Island plants of Sperry Gyroscope, the same company which pioneered in aviation more than a half century ago in New York State. 200 different products are made by the skilled hands of these men and women, applying every one of our known sciences. Well, our story today has been mostly about the little black box, the automatic pilot for aircraft. And we haven't had time to talk about the other amazing inventions which began with Dr. Elmer Sperry. But they've been coming out thick and fast from this company's engineers and workers ever since. Wherever ships sail, wherever planes fly, in military or commercial aviation, and wherever messages or television programs are sent through the air, the people at Sperry are helping to make our lives safer, pleasanter, or more profitable. The enterprise and imagination of one man started this industry, but it had to be carried on by a tremendous team of skilled men and women. Their freedom to experiment, to work, to fail or succeed, along with the rest of the aviation industry in New York State, has given us much of the security, the means, and the leisure to enjoy our freedom's blessings.
Uncle York, the fine old feller, going to be our storyteller. Told a story of men who fly, going to tell another one by and by. Uncle York, the fine old feller, he is sure our storyteller. We've been around for a century, keeping an eye on you and me.
Our Freedom's Blessings, Untuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from April 19, 1952. It's an hour of true history, Untuned to Yesterday, now wrapping up with an episode of Adventures in Research with the story The Missing Ingredient.
Adventures in Research. Several hundred years ago, Shakespeare wrote, "Some men are born great. Some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them." The principal character of today's story, Nicholas LeBlanc, belongs in the third category. He had greatness thrust upon him, and all because of a cook who supplied the missing ingredient. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science, produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Although Nicholas LeBlanc was a Frenchman, the initial circumstances which led to his scientific contribution didn't happen in France at all, but in Spain. Our story begins shortly before the French Revolution. We're aboard a Spanish ship in a Spanish port, and the captain is noticeably upset.
Senor Colonel, I do not understand by what right you come aboard my ship and tell me what my cargo shall be. After all, you are an officer of a foreign power.
I am sorry, Captain, but those are my orders. Furthermore, I do not tell you what your cargo shall be. I merely tell you what it shall not be.
If our two countries were still at war, I could comprehend. But we Spaniards are now at peace with you.
Captain, believe me, this is none of my doing.
Oh, I suppose not. But why are you here? Why Pray tell me, are British troops still in Spain?
That, Captain, is a political question which I am not qualified to answer.
Well, perhaps you can tell me why, in my own country, aboard my own ship, I am treated as a prisoner of war.
A prisoner of war, Captain? Hardly.
And what do you call boarding my ship and telling me what my cargo will be?
There is a reason, a very good reason. You are carrying soda ash to France.
True, true, but by what right do you presume...
By command of His Britannic Majesty. Believe me, Captain, I have enough men to seize this entire port if necessary. I ask you to allow me to do my duty without bloodshed.
And what am I to do with my cargo? Throw it into the sea?
Put it aboard a ship bound for England. You will get a good price, I warrant you.
But I have already made an agreement with the French.
His Majesty's government does not recognize agreements with the French.
So, in the meantime, I must unload my entire ship, remove the soda ash, and then reload it on a ship bound for England, correct?
I am afraid that it is.
My men will complain.
They will complain louder if I force them at gunpoint.
Que puedo hacer? You win, Senor Colonel. But only because I am unarmed. If I had even one cannon...
You would do what I should do in your place. You would fight.
Si, senor.
I respect your bravery and your good judgment. Now let us have that soda ash unloaded, and quickly.
When news of the British action reached France, it produced an immediate and violent reaction in commercial circles. Soda ash was a vital ingredient in the manufacture of soap, paper, glass, textiles, and other chemicals. The French government was forced to act. Action took the form of a cash prize for making soda ash artificially, a prize which sent many French scientists scurrying to their laboratories, all of which didn't in the least concern Nicolas Leblanc, personal physician to the Duke of Orléans. We meet him first in the Duke's bedchamber, where he's concentrating on the difficult job of taking the Duke's pulse.
Somewhat fast, Your Grace, but I am confident that with simple diet and sufficient sleep...
Really, Leblanc, as my personal physician, you should know me better. A simple diet and sufficient sleep, indeed. Not for Philip, Duke of Orléans.
But, Your Grace, I was merely suggesting...
I know. And I suppose it is not your fault. You are a scientist.
Well, what next? I should like very much to listen to Your Grace's chest.
Is that all? Go ahead.
I thank Your Grace. If you will hold still, please. There.
Is it satisfactory?
I must have quiet, Your Grace.
Oh, excuse me. A pinch of snuff, Leblanc.
Your Grace, I beseech you. Quiet.
Very well, then I will. Hey!
Well, indeed, Your Grace, I cannot...
Come, Leblanc. Forget your bedside mannerisms. I am not one of your village patients. I may someday be King of France.
King of France?
And why not? There is talk of revolution. Revolution against Louis.
Yes, but Your Grace, I...
Leblanc, have you not noticed how the rabble cheer my coach in the streets?
I have.
I tell you, they love me. They think I am one of them. Now, what more natural chain of events? They depose Louis, they enthrone me.
It is almost too much to comprehend.
Only for a man with a small mind. As for me, I can see it as clearly as I see the morning sun. Philip, King of France, and you, Leblanc, will be my royal physician.
Oh, Your Grace.
How would you like that, eh? Much more money, Leblanc. Much more than I give you now. Which means you must increase your reputation as a scientist. You must begin now.
But, Your Grace,
The Academy of Science is offering a prize of 100,000 francs for the discovery of a process for making soda ash artificially. If you should win, Leblanc, your name would be made.
But, Your Grace, I am no chemist.
Right now, you are both a mediocre physician and a mediocre chemist. Remember, Leblanc, if you follow me, you abandon mediocrity. I despise it wherever I find it.
I see.
Well, you are interested, eh, Leblanc?
Very much so, Your Grace. Very much so.
LeBlanc knew, of course, that soda ash is sodium carbonate, and he soon learned that many chemists had struggled without success to prepare it artificially. The closest approach had been made by the French chemist de la Mettrie in 1789. He had heated salt in the presence of sulfuric acid. To the resulting sodium sulfate, he added charcoal and then heated again. The end product was chiefly sodium sulfide, but no one had been able to convert the sodium sulfide to sodium carbonate. Meanwhile, events in France moved rapidly. July 14, 1789, the fall of the Bastille.
The court blames the taking of the Bastille on the Duke of Orléans.
August 4, 1789, the National Assembly adopts the Declaration of the Rights of Man.
The king orders the Duke of Orléans out of the country, to England.
June 20, 1791, the royal family, attempting to escape from France, is stopped at the border and forced to return to Paris as prisoners. Yes, with each passing day, political history was made. But in Nicolas LeBlanc's laboratory, a different kind of history was being written. And the key that unlocked the secret came quite by accident. One day, in the palace of the Duke of Orléans, LeBlanc was at work in a small laboratory the Duke had provided when he had a visitor, the Duke's cook.
Open up, LeBlanc! Open the door!
I am coming! Oh, it is you, Francois. Come in. Sit down.
Thank you, LeBlanc.
You seem slightly out of breath. In a hurry, Francois?
Not particularly, LeBlanc. Why do you ask?
I thought someone might be trying to find you. The Duke, perhaps?
Him. It is an equality, he calls himself. If I had my say, I would give him equality, all right.
Indeed. But the people, they love him, Francois.
They may love him today, LeBlanc. They will hate him tomorrow.
But he is one of them, Francois. He sits in the National Assembly.
The people are not easily fooled. Soon they will know him for what he is. An opportunist, a pretender, and a fool.
Tell me, Francois, you are remarkably well informed for a cook. Does Citizen Mirabeau come every day to your kitchen to discuss politics?
Perhaps it would be better for you if you took a greater interest in politics, LeBlanc. Instead of spending your time with beakers and chemicals and experiments, and for what?
For what do you think, Francois?
For the Duke. So he can wring the secret from you. So he can add to his own glory and the gold in his pockets. LeBlanc, you are a fool.
You are very free with that word, my friend. I think it is you who are the fool.
Be careful what you say, LeBlanc. I have connections.
In the Committee for Public Safety, perhaps?
You know?
That you are a member? Of course I know.
But you... The Duke, does he...
Does he suspect? I doubt it. Sometimes I think he is almost as big a fool as you.
He is an enemy of the people.
He is many things, my friend. And right now, he is suspicious.
Suspicious? Of what?
Of strange words that keep appearing throughout the castle, on the walls, the floors, the walks outside. Messages reading, down with the Duke, death to Philip Equality. And all of these messages are written in chalk.
Written in chalk?
What did you do with it, my friend?
Do with what?
The chalk you had when you came in such a hurry.
But I did not...
Do not deny it. I may be a mediocre chemist, but even a mediocre chemist can recognize the difference between chalk dust and flour on a cook's hand.
I dropped it in that flask, LeBlanc. The one on the fire, there by the door.
How clever of you.
Someone was spying on me. I ran. I could...
No, of course. But you would select that flask. Oh, from the looks of it, you have ruined my experiment.
I am sorry, LeBlanc.
Oh, did you ruin it? This is most interesting.
LeBlanc, open the door!
The Duke!
One moment, Your Grace.
LeBlanc, there is more of the writing, more of it. Did you see? You, what are you doing here?
Well,
He is assisting me, Your Grace, in my experiments.
Yes, Your Grace.
Nonsense. I do not believe it. I think...
Think what you will, Your Grace. But here, at last, in this flask, is the soda ash we seek. And I might never have found it except for your cook.
Wonderful. You mean he?
I mean Francois supplied the missing ingredient. Calcium carbonate.
Yes, the secret to preparing soda ash was the addition of calcium carbonate in the form of chalk or limestone. History records that LeBlanc won his prize in 1791, and, financed by the Duke, he built a factory for the commercial manufacture of sodium carbonate. But in 1793, the reign of terror swept everything before it, Duke, factory, and all. Only LeBlanc survived. In 1800, his factory was returned to him, but he could obtain no financial support for its operation. And so in 1806, worn out with disappointment, Nicholas LeBlanc died, a suicide. And while his method for making soda ash long since has been replaced by the better, cheaper Solvay process, to Nicholas LeBlanc does go credit for being the first to produce a basic chemical on a large scale from cheap raw materials, and by so doing, to speed the day of the modern chemical industry with his ill-fated adventure in research.
Adventures in Research from the later 1940s from Westinghouse Syndication, wrapping up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.